Well, it's now 8 a.m. You are tuned to WZBC Newton, and any views expressed are not necessarily those of WZBC Boston College or its Board of Trustees. And it is now time for This Week in Palestine.
إلى بلد مهجر. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is John Roberts. The entire broadcast this morning is dedicated to the memory of a remarkable human being, Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj, a psychiatrist and physician who founded and directed the Gaza Mental Health Center. Dr. El-Sarraj died December 17, 2013, and his friends here in the Boston area, and there are many, held a special commemorative service in Cambridge on October 28th to honor his work. Although Dr. El-Sarraj was there for everyone, his focus was on caring for the children of Gaza, a population of children who are deeply traumatized by the continuing reign of terror perpetrated by the Israeli military. Every child in Gaza, 8 years or over, has had to endure at least 4 sustained military bombardments, the likes of cast lead, that is, once every 2 years. And that has left an entire generation of children traumatized. No one escapes the scars of that kind of bombardment and wholesale devastation. That was Dr. El-Sarraj's challenge, helping those children deal with the trauma of war. But Dr. El-Sarraj's reach was far beyond Gaza. He also touched the lives of many of us in Cambridge, who were fortunate enough to know him and who worked to support him in the work of the Gaza Mental Health Center. This morning you will hear three of his friends and colleagues speak about the work of Dr. El-Sarraj and life in Gaza. Nancy Murray, founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, Sarah Roy, Middle East researcher at Harvard, and Dr. Noam Chomsky. Here are their tributes. The introduction is by Hilary Rentisi.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to introduce Nancy Murray, who doesn't need an introduction. I'm sure many of you know her. Nancy is a co-founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation and is an inspiration to many of us.
Thank you so much, Hilary, and thank all of you for being here. And I would like to just recognize the other co-founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, Elaine Hagopian, who I know most of you know here. We established the Gaza Mental Health Foundation in 2001 to support the work of Dr. El-Sarraj's Gaza Community Mental Health Program and eventually other mental health projects in the Gaza Strip. Now, we started planning this tribute to Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj a few months after his death on December 17, 2013, and well before Israel's attacks in the summer of 2014, which produced the images you have just seen and again brought the Gaza Strip briefly to the attention of the world. For Dr. El-Sarraj, mental health and human rights went hand in hand, and is not hard to imagine what he would be doing and saying if he were with us today. He would be working to restore dignity and hope to those who have described themselves as feeling broken or destroyed, and would be doing everything in his power to awaken the conscience of the world, to demand an end to the perpetual human rights emergency in which Gazans are forced to live. Quote, "Our wounds in Gaza are still open, our justice still denied," end quote, Dr. El-Sarraj wrote to President Obama in September 2009, 9 months after Israel's Operation Cast Lead reduced large portions of the Gaza Strip to rubble, and its draconian siege made it all but impossible to carry out a rebuilding process. The letter continues, quote, "The war and the continued closure of the Gaza Strip have undermined the capacity of mothers and fathers to act as protectors and providers. As a community, we will struggle for decades to live with the consequences," end quote. I first met Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj 26 years ago during an earlier phase of the human rights emergency. I was in Gaza as part of a fact-finding delegation soon after the first intifada began. And I will never forget the shock of seeing hospitals full of young men and children who had endured the, quote, "force, might, and beatings" employed by the Israeli army to put down an unarmed civil uprising of the entire population. I'll never forget hearing screams and gunshots and the wailing of ambulances all night long. In 1988, and for the next 5 years, a 7 p.m. curfew was imposed on the Gaza Strip, and anyone who violated it could be shot. But Iyad El-Sarraj was not about to abide by this military order. Instead, every evening, he would go where he was needed in his small car, giving solace and medical attention. He made no attempt to avoid the army convoys, but instead would purposefully go his way, sometimes with me in the passenger seat. So brazen was he in breaking the rules that the soldiers must have assumed he had a special permit, which he did not. What he did have was a determination to live in open, nonviolent defiance of occupation, both as an assertion of his own humanity and in recognition of the humanity of others, Israelis as well as Palestinians. There was a feature story about Iyad El-Sarraj in the Canadian magazine Equinox, published in February 1995, which illustrates this quality. Quote, "He was once stopped during the Intifada and ordered by an Israeli soldier to extinguish flames from a burning tire with his bare hands. He refused the order. When the soldier threatened to take his identification card, El-Sarraj didn't protest. 'Go ahead, take it. I don't care,' he said. And when the soldier threatened to beat him, El-Sarraj said, 'Go ahead, but before you do, I know there is a real human being behind that uniform, and I would like you to show me that person.' The soldier got tears in his eyes, and then he just walked away," end quote. How was it possible to maintain sanity under the dehumanizing conditions of occupation? When the first intifada was at its peak, Iyad set about creating a center that would work to overcome the stigma attached to mental illness and provide family and community-based treatment on a huge scale. In 1990, he opened the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, which soon had clinics in the refugee camps. Before long, it had established a range of training programs, crisis intervention programs, special projects that worked with children and people who had been victims of torture. He had an empowerment women's program and a training and education department offering courses for teachers and nurses, as well as a postgraduate diploma in community mental health and human rights. I learned a lot about the hopes and aspirations of Palestinians in Gaza when I taught a course in human rights law to the diploma students, which included drawing up a constitution for the future Palestine. I would now like to introduce someone who has been a close friend of Dr. Iyad Sarraj over the decades and serves as a trustee of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Sarah Roy, who is a senior research scholar at Harvard's Center for Middle Eastern Studies, is an extraordinary researcher and writer. Among her more than 100 publications are groundbreaking works about the Gaza Strip, including The Gaza Strip, The Political Economy of De-Development, and the award-winning Hamas and Civil Society in Gaza, Engaging the Islamist Social Sector, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2001. Sarah, would you please come up?
Thank you all very much. Over 20 years ago, I encountered a woman in a refugee camp in Gaza, whom I've never forgotten. It was a painfully brief encounter, ending as imperceptibly as it began. I was walking in the camp with some male friends when a woman unexpectedly approached me. She took my arm and pulled me toward her and said to me, quote, "I have nothing left to feed my children but black milk. And what good am I?" Before I could respond, clearly at a loss as to how, or think to hold on to her hand, which was momentarily fastened to my arm, she disappeared into the camp, evaporating, it seemed, into an expanse of dust and air. I stood there stunned, trying to understand what had just happened, tears welling in my eyes. My friends, clearly embarrassed by the encounter, simply dismissed her as someone pitiable, even crazy. When I was asked to prepare this tribute to Iyad, I immediately thought of this woman, whom I shall call Nadia, and my few searing moments with her. To this day, I wish Iyad had been with me that day in the camp. He would not have been ashamed by Nadia, as my male friends apparently were, but would have reached out to her and embraced her, offering her the comfort she so desperately needed. By now, much has been written about Iyad, his background, his work, and his many professional achievements and honors. I shall not repeat what others have said. Rather, I would want to share some personal experiences with this remarkable man, one of which I have never before revealed, that powerfully express who he was. I met Iyad in the summer of 1985 during my first visit to Gaza. I was there to do fieldwork for my doctoral dissertation on American economic assistance to the Palestinians in the occupied territories. I was urged to meet Dr. El-Sarraj, whom I was told was the only psychiatrist in the Gaza Strip. He was also the director of the mental health service in Gaza's Department of Health, which was under the control of the Israeli military authorities. Our first meeting was at the Marna House, a small hotel where I was staying. Iyad walked into the parlor of the hotel, and I remember a tall, handsome man whose presence filled the room. We spent a long time talking, although I do not remember for how long. What I do remember was his fierce honesty and the absence of any sense of caution or tentativeness. Where others were initially and understandably careful in speaking with me, a foreigner with whom they did not know, Iyad was open, direct, and resolute. I did not see much of Iyad that summer, but that changed when I returned to Gaza in early 1986 to do additional fieldwork for a study of conditions in the Gaza Strip for the West Bank Database Project under the direction of Meron Benveniste. One sector I was tasked to describe was health, and I very much wanted to visit Shifa Hospital, then Gaza's main hospital run by the Israeli military government. However, the Israeli authorities prohibited access to Shifa by foreigners, and the only way one could enter was with official permission, which was rarely granted. I called Iyad, hoping he might have some needed influence with the military administration. He listened to me and told me he would meet me at the Marna House the following morning. I assumed it was to discuss how best to approach the authorities for permission. When Iyad showed up at the Marna house, he greeted me warmly, and we had the following exchange. He said, "Let's go, Sarah." "Let's go where?" I asked. "Shifa." "Shifa? You mean you got me permission?" "No, you will never get permission. And when you are inside the hospital, you will understand why. I shall bring you in because you must see for yourself the conditions in the hospital. Iyad, you could get into serious trouble with the authorities. You might lose your job. I don't want you to take such risks for me, and I'm not asking you to do so." "I'm not worried," he said, "but you must write about what you see, about everything I show you." At considerable risk to himself, and it was only later from others that I learned how great the risk actually was, Iyad surreptitiously brought me into Shifa, walking me through the entire hospital, including the operating room. He allowed me to take as much time as I needed, despite the worried looks of the hospital staff. He did not say too much, but he did not have to. Conditions inside the hospital were appalling, as the following excerpt from my published report, The Gaza Strip Survey, shows, and I quote myself. "Mice, roaches, and other insects were observed scurrying through individual wards, rooms, and bathrooms. Rooms were extremely dirty and in a state of decay, as indicated by broken windows, peeling paint, and cracked floors. Hospital beds were old and rusting, and patients were observed two to a bed, lying on sheets that were torn and bloodstained. Hospital personnel indicated that the same sheets are often used for more than one patient due to a lack of supplies. Rooms are cleaned only when patients can afford to pay. The surgical operating room was in a similar state of deterioration and extremely unsterile. Cigarette butts were observed on the floor of the OR." End quote. This one paragraph caught the attention of the international media, and a firestorm ensued, including a four-minute segment on life inside Gaza on the ABC Evening News. Iyad told me that the Palestinian director of the hospital was fired and that hospital conditions soon improved, but only temporarily. After Shifa was cleaned and repaired, the military government invited various international groups and organizations into the hospital as a way of refuting my claims. The Knesset even threatened to subpoena Maron and me, since they accused us of having been paid by the PLO to write the report. I was often asked how I got access to the hospital, which I never revealed until now. I remember receiving a call in Boston from a senior official at the American Embassy in Tel Aviv, who, surprised that I managed to get into Shifa, asked me whether I had seen dogs running through the hospital as he had when he was last there. Many people thanked me for exposing the conditions in Shifa, but it was Iyad who was truly responsible for doing so. Iyad was an extremely principled man, and he did not fear retribution for actions he believed in. I remember another time, years later, sitting with him in the garden of his home. It was the spring of 1996, and not long before he had been appointed the Commissioner General of the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights. Iyad was very upset about the behavior of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza and its increasingly flagrant abuse of human rights. But what outraged him most, it seemed to me, was the facile, almost effortless nature of the PA's abuse, the ease with which they oppressed their own people, and the total lack of remorse that defined their abuse. His anger was palpable, but so were his pain and the feeling that his beloved Gaza had been betrayed once again. He told me how he was going to publicly expose the PA in an effort to initiate a process of reform. I remember feeling anxious and tense, fearing, I told him, his arrest and possible torture, which is what subsequently happened. Iyad, however, remained consistent and unwavering, telling me that silence is not an option. In the near three decades of our friendship, I came to know Iyad very well. There are few people for whom I have more respect, admiration, and affection. I always learned from his example. He was, as others have written, long and deeply committed to addressing trauma, especially in children, and to protecting and honoring the dignity of the individual, irrespective of religion or nationality. For me, Iyad's most important legacy lies in one fundamental belief which animated his life. While resistance to oppression can assume many forms, the most powerful form of resistance resides in maintaining one's humanity, in the presence of cruelty, and in seeking that humanity in others, including in one's oppressors. Such resistance, he believed, can never be extinguished. I would now ask Stuart Ting Chong to come up to the platform and read a message to this gathering from Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Stuart is a South African by birth who now lives and works in the United States. He was for many years a personal staff member to the Archbishop. So Stuart, would you please come and read the message? Thank you.
I received this email on the 29th of September from Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Emeritus. Dear friends, the horror and devastation of war is evident in the photographs captured on social media and the news, but the psychological trauma inflicted on all victims remain invisible to the world. Many victims suffer life-changing injuries or witness family members killed and homes, schools, and mosques destroyed. PTSD increases with each cycle of violence. The legacy of Dr. Iyad Sarraj will continue in the Gaza Strip as long as organizations like the Gaza Community Mental Health Program exist to help such victims. Their staff caring for the psychologically wounded while often enduring similar trauma as those they treat. God is evident in Gaza, evident by the hearts and hands of those who spread God's grace and mercy. God bless you, Desmond.
Our next speaker has educated and inspired generations of people around the world. No one has done more in this country to put the Palestinians on the map, and no one has given more generously of his time and energy to reach audiences across the United States and beyond. And how he has managed to do this while teaching, making major breakthroughs in linguistics, writing some 125 books, I counted them, and thousands of articles, and responding to a daily barrage of emails is beyond me. He has known Dr. El-Sarraj for more than 20 years. I recall the three of us being together in Wichita, Kansas, shortly after the Oslo peace process was launched. Professor Chomsky last saw Iyad in Gaza a year before his death. Please welcome Noam Chomsky.
One evening, a few days ago, I received a phone call from a friend in Gaza, Mohammed Omer. He's a young, courageous, a very distinguished journalist who has been recording carefully the latest Israeli atrocities daily and the amazing resilience of the victims in Gaza, and has been doing it for many years. His personal history is kind of a microcosm of the sadism of the occupation. He was awarded a couple of years ago, he was awarded an important prize, the Martha Gellhorn Prize for International Journalism, and the Israeli authorities at first refused to let him leave to accept it, but due to a lot of international pressure, he happens to be a Dutch citizen as well as a Gazan Palestinian, They finally allowed him out, more or less. As he left the border crossing, he was savagely beaten by the soldiers of the most moral army in the world, so severely that for years he's had to undergo medical treatment in Amsterdam in the United States, still suffers from it, but he constantly returns. He returns to record what is happening and the resilience of the population. There's only one really important comment that I'd like to make, and that is that we're responsible for this. We are the ones who are responsible for the shameful record of atrocities that directly with our tax dollars and indirectly, but very significantly through our failure to put an end to the decisive support for these crimes by the United States in many dimensions, military, economic, diplomatic, and ideological, not least, namely in permitting the imagery of Israeli propaganda to prevail in the United States. Fortunately, not many other places, but in the United States, the image of Israel, the victim, the pathetic victim of the Palestinian population, the most evil of them in Gaza, who are dedicated to destroy Israel, which only hopes to live in peace. This image is adds to the humiliation and degradation of a brutalized population who see themselves turned into the perpetrators of the terror and violence. The last time I met Muhammad was actually at Ayad's home in Gaza. I was there visiting with my friend Asaf Khoury. We had been invited by Ayad to visit among other things, his health was already in serious decline. The picture on the announcement describes is a picture of a meeting that he organized and moderated in Gaza, discussion period. At his home, he and his friend Raji Sarani, another marvelous person, described the conditions of life in Gaza, the pressure cooker, as they described it, which is looks as though it's about to explode at any moment, and the amazing fact that there isn't a massive explosion of rage and violence. And when I spoke to Muhammad a couple of days ago, he gave me another typical update. He has a 6-year-old child who was in the hospital for dehydration, because there is no water. There's no water to drink. Israel's destroyed the sewage plants, the power plants. They won't allow chemicals in. So his 6-month-old son is hospitalized for dehydration. He described how in the region, especially in the parts of Gaza that were virtually devastated, Shafaya, Beit Hanun, people are trying to survive outdoors in a cold, driving rain, or in hovels that have been broken down, beaten into ruins, but they continue somehow. I was there. Asaf and I were there shortly. Actually, we were also there to lecture at the Islamic University, which has been a regular target of Israeli attacks on pretexts to. Ludicrous to discuss, though they're accepted here. Again, in the most recent episode this summer of Israel's shooting fish in the pond using advanced weaponry, which we were gracious enough to provide them with. Muhammad, Ayad has also remained through the worst atrocities. With remarkable courage and dedication, he has devoted his energies to dealing with the traumas of an imprisoned population trying to survive under a vicious siege, which is very carefully constructed by the Israeli authorities in specific, explicit detail to keep them at the bare level of survival. It wouldn't look good if they all starved to death, so the animals have to be kept just barely alive. The Israeli violence is constant, never stops, but it's punctuated every once in a while by an episode of what Israel calls mowing the lawn to teach the prisoners not to raise their heads and to submit to the occupation. This is considered legitimate in the United States because the victims are what George Orwell called unpeople, not worthy of our concern, in fact, appropriate for us to help kill. That Gaza remains under Israeli occupation is not in doubt. It's accepted by the world outside of Israel, even by the United States. Well, our visit, as Nancy said, was in October 2012. A couple of weeks later, Israel decided to mow the lawn again. That was Operation Pillar of Cloud, as always, on ludicrous pretexts, as always accepted here. After the appropriate dose of violence and humiliation, Israel agreed to a ceasefire, which repeated the usual terms. Here they are: a cessation of military action by both sides and the effective ending of the siege of Gaza, with Israel opening the crossings, facilitating the movements of people and transfer of goods, and refraining from restricting residents' free movements and targeting residents in border areas, an end to all of that. Those are the terms, the normal ones. What followed next, I'll simply quote from a highly respected, maybe the most respected independent analyst, the Middle East analyst of the International Crisis Group, Nathan Thrall. He says that Israeli intelligence recognized that Hamas was observing the terms of the ceasefire. Israel therefore saw little incentive in upholding its end of the deal. In the 3 months following the ceasefire, its forces made regular incursions into Gaza, strafed Palestinian farmers and those collecting scrap and rubble across the border, fired boats, preventing fishermen from accessing the majority of Gaza's waters. Actually, they're forced to fish a couple of kilometers offshore in completely polluted water after the sewage system and power system been destroyed by Israeli attacks. Crossings were repeatedly shut. So-called buffer zones inside Gaza were reinstated. These are zones from which Palestinians are barred. They constitute maybe a third or more of Gaza's limited arable land. Continuing to quote Thrall, imports declined, exports were blocked, fewer Gazans were given exit permits to Israel and the West Bank. Well, so matters continued for 18 months until April of this year, when a very important event took place. A unity government was formed between Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the Fatah Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. This was a remarkable agreement. Hamas had actually been trying to reach it for many years. Hamas made major concessions. The unity government contained no Hamas members or allies. Hamas even turned over a large part of the government of Gaza to the Palestinian, the West Bank Palestinian Authority. And remember that Hamas was the victor in the one free election that has ever taken place, not only in Palestine, but in the Arab world. I'll get back to that. The unity government accepted the three conditions that Washington and the European Union have repeatedly demaned: nonviolence, adherence to past agreements, and recognition of Israel. never reported is the fact that Israel, of course, rejects all of the three conditions completely. Don't have to talk about nonviolence. Adherence to past agreements, it's a bad joke. There is what's called a roadmap to peace proposed by George W. Bush and the international community. Israel accepted it, but at once added 14 conditions, reservations, which completely undermined it. The fact that it was never reported here until Jimmy Carter included the details in the appendix to his Peace or Apartheid book. And of course, Israel not only doesn't recognize Palestine, but the electoral program of the governing party declares explicitly that there can never be any self-determination for Palestinians in the former Palestine, west of the Jordan. They incidentally regard Jordan as a Palestinian state, as does the opposition Labor Party. Israel was infuriated by the unity government agreement. It declared at once that it would not deal with the unity government, and it terminated the pretty meaningless negotiations. And their fury mounted even further when most of the world supported the unity government, including even the United States. There are very good reasons why Israel objects to unification of Gaza and the West Bank. One reason is that the lack of unity had offered a pretext for evading negotiations. How can you negotiate with two conflicted parties? So that's gone. But a more serious problem is obvious when you look at a map. Take a look at a map and you can see right away that any small regions within the West Bank that might ultimately be granted some kind of autonomy are completely imprisoned. On the one hand, one side is Israel, on the other side the Jordanian dictatorship, both of them allies of the United States, which of course is extremely hostile to the Palestinians. Gaza offers the one outlet to the outside world. So therefore, it's not surprising that for the past more than 20 years, Israel, with U.S. backing, has been seeking to keep them separate, in violation, incidentally, of the terms of the Oslo Agreement 20 years ago, which declare them to be an inseparable territorial unity. Furthermore, Israel has been systematically taking over the Jordan Valley, driving out Palestinian inhabitants, farmers, shepherds, others, bringing in Jewish settlers, sinking wells, creating military zones from which Palestinians are excluded, though ultimately Jewish settlements are established, and in general moving step by step to integrate this region, about a third of the West Bank, into what the greater Israel that they're busy constructing. That means that any autonomous cantons that might be left to Palestinians will be multiply imprisoned. So with only, and of course this would be undermined if there was a connection to Gaza. Incidentally, this is supported by all the major political blocs, including the so-called doves. Shimon Peres, former president, hailed here as a leading dove, was in fact one of the primary architects of Israeli settlement, illegal settlement, of course, deep inside Gaza, deep inside the West Bank. Returning to the unity agreement last April, Israel responded by launching a huge wave of repression, but primarily in the West Bank, also in Gaza, targeting Hamas. As always, there was a pretext. Pretext collapses very quickly on examination. And as always, it was accepted here. And finally, the repression did elicit a limited Hamas reaction, which was the pretext for launching Operation Preventive Edge, which you just saw, by far the most murderous and savage of Israel's attacks on Gaza. What I've just described is a pattern that is uniform, repeated over and over. It takes genius for the press not to perceive it. What happens over and over is that a ceasefire is established, Israel completely ignores it, Hamas lives up to it, as Israel concedes, until the unremitting Israeli violence escalates sharply, at which point there sometimes is a Hamas reaction and a pretext for the next episode of mowing the lawn. This has been going on. There's a long and bitter history, which I'll skip, but this pattern has been going on since November 2005. November 2005, there was an agreement called the Agreement on Movement and Access between Israel's Health and In Authority. I'll closely paraphrase it. It established a crossing between Gaza and Egypt at Rafah for the export of goods and the transit of people, continuous operation of crossings between Israel and Gaza for the import and export of goods and the transit of people, a reduction of obstacles to movement within the West Bank, bus and truck convoys between the West Bank and Gaza, the building of a seaport in Gaza, and reopening of the airport in Gaza that Israel had destroyed. Those are essentially the terms of the successive ceasefires, including the recent one last August 26th. The timing of this agreement is important. It was time at the moment of the so-called Israeli disengagement from Gaza. That's portrayed by Israeli propaganda and loyally repeated here as a noble effort to achieve peace and open the way to development of Gaza. The reality is radically different. The goal of the disengagement was the freezing of the peace process so as to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state and to ensure that diplomacy has been removed indefinitely from the agenda. And not my words. Those are the words of Dov Weissglass, the close associate of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who in fact negotiated and implemented the disengagement. It's described, what actually happened is described eloquently by the Israeli scholars who've published a major work on the whole settlement program, Edith Zertal, noted historian, and Akiva Eldar, Israel's leading diplomatic correspondent. What they say is that the ruined territory of Gaza was not released for even a single day from Israel's military grip or from the price of the occupation that the inhabitants pay every day. After the disengagement, Israel left behind scorched earth, devastated services, and people with neither a present nor a future. The settlements were destroyed in an ungenerous move by an unenlightened occupier, which in fact continues to control the territory and kill and harass its inhabitants by means of its formidable military might. The disengagement was a perfectly rational decision on the part of Israeli hawks. They understood that it didn't make any sense, now that Gaza had been virtually destroyed, to leave a few thousand Israeli settlers in illegal, subsidized settlements in Gaza, appropriating a large part of its meager resources and protected by a huge contingent of the Israeli army. It made a lot more sense to move them from their illegal, subsidized settlements in Gaza to illegal, subsidized settlements in the West Bank in areas that Israel intends to keep. It would have been very simple to implement the disengagement. All that would have been required was a notice that on a particular day the Israeli army would leave. At that point, all the settlers would climb into the lorries that are provided to them and be moved to their new subsidized illegal homes in the West Bank. But of course, that would not have been a propaganda achievement. So instead, what happened was a staged trauma intended for the American audience. Those of you who are here may remember the Boston Globe in 2005, typical big front-page pictures of a little boy pleading with the soldiers not to destroy his home, and underneath it says, "Never again," which means don't tell us to abandon what we now have in the West Bank. The act played quite well here. It was ridiculed in Israel, but that's normal. The agreement of 2005, November 2005, lasted a few weeks. In January 2006, the Palestinians committed a real crime. There was a free election, open, carefully monitored free election, and they voted the wrong way. Hamas took control of the parliament. The U.S. and Israel do not believe in democracy, but only if it comes out the right way. This instantly led to a sharp escalation of the siege, the violent Israeli siege and violence. The U.S. totally supported it. The U.S. Also initiated plans to carry out a military coup to overthrow the elected government. That, again, is quite normal. Hamas actually preempted the coup and blocked it. The way that's described in the United States is that Hamas took over the Gaza Strip by force, which is not false, but something rather critical is omitted. Well, going back to the disengagement, the Israeli tale, as usual, adopted here, is that Israel had offered Gaza this wonderful opportunity to develop for development, but instead Hamas immediately launched a torrent of rockets at defenseless Israel. So what could they do? Actually, there was one rocket which landed of unknown origin, which landed somewhere in a field harmlessly. That's the torrent of rockets before the escalation of January in reaction to the January election. I won't review the rest of the story. It's the same throughout. The pattern is very clear. For the moment, it seems to be continuing. There was the latest ceasefire on August 26th, usual terms. Israel has instantly violated it. It at once announced the biggest land grab in 30 years, roughly 1,000 acres in Gush Etzion, where there are a couple of dozen Israeli settlements, of course illegal, in what Israel calls Greater Jerusalem, a huge area which had nothing to do with Jerusalem in the past, takes in a lot of the West Bank. The U.S. did react. Here's the reaction. The U.S. State Department informed the Israeli embassy that Israeli settlement activity in Gush Etzion undermined American efforts to protect Israel at the United Nations and urged that Israel not provide ammunition for those at the UN who would interpret Israel's position as hardening. Now, that's almost correct, not quite. That warning was actually 47 years ago. In September 1967, when Israel began its illegal settlement activities. Very little has changed since, except for the scale of the crimes, which continue and continue to escalate without a break, and will continue as long as the United States continues to support them. The best tribute we can pay to this remarkable person who we're honoring tonight, Eyad Sarraj, would be to devote ourselves to bringing these horrible crimes to an end.
You have been listening to excerpts from the memorial service for Dr. Iyad El Sarraj, former director of the Gaza Mental Health Center, by Nancy Murray, Sarah Roy, and Noam Chomsky. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our full archive of past broadcasts, type in your browser, truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. You will find our past programs there. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.